dressed in metal, Batman.
Huh?
Welcome to 50% Fresh. My name's Mark.
I'm Taylor.
Today, we are going to be discussing a movie that received bad reviews, as we always do. And today's film is 1995's Batman Forever, starring Val Kilmer as a very short-lived Batman, among other things. A ton to talk about today.
Is he the only Batman to play Batman for one movie?
One and done, then Clooney right after him. Schumacher couldn't keep a Batman, you know?
Right, yeah, of course.
It's funny because all these people, like, when you're Michael Keaton and you're Batman from 1989 and then the movie 1992, they're only for like 3 or 4 years or whatever. But when you're Val Kilmer, you're really only Batman for like 2 hours in 1995, you know? And then that's it.
He was promised forever.
The opposite, the shortest one, actually, yeah. So,
Prior to our most recent viewing of this, it was definitely a movie I've seen in my childhood, but I did not remember it at all. I mostly remembered Jim Carrey as the Riddler running around being a Looney Tune.
Mm-hmm. Hard. That's definitely, if you remember one thing, it might be that, of course. That makes a lot of sense.
I was the target audience for that.
Yeah. And I'm sure we'll talk about that, but like me too. I'm a little bit older, so I definitely remember 95. I would have been, if it was summertime, 10 years old. Definitely just the kind of kid that wants to go see Batman Forever in the summertime. And I'm sure we went to see it. I remember it vaguely. It was just like, Batman Returns knocked me on my, you know, it was a crazy movie. Batman Returns is like really cool. And I was really young, so it felt like I was getting away with seeing like an R-rated movie because Batman Returns is like messed up. And we'll talk about that later too. But Batman Forever, I thought, was just like fine. Maybe not. You know, I liked the Tim Burton stuff a little. I felt off because it's like different vibe, different Batman. But Tommy Lee Jones and Jim Carrey are just like, that felt fine to have some cool actors playing cool villains. That's what we do here kind of thing. So I liked it, but I think I liked the ones that preceded it more.
I did too. Yeah. I would have been 4 in 95. So I definitely think I didn't see it until it was on VHS
mm-hmm.
somewhere there in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. But I'm with you with the, and then you get older and you find out that, oh, Tim Burton also made Beetlejuice and all these other movies that I think are cool and weird and
mm-hmm.
a little mm-hmm. spooky, but mm-hmm. I'm intrigued.
On that note, yeah, definitely. And on that note, with him, Tim Burton stepping away, Batman Forever, directed by Joel Schumacher, who's done some cool movies. I like some of his movies. The Lost Boys. There's a movie Falling Down with Michael Douglas that's become kind of a hot potato, but I think it rips.
The more I read about Joel Schumacher doing research for the podcast, mm-hmm. the more I liked the guy. He has a lot of very funny... He's just a funny guy.
He's got sort of an eclectic filmography, right? Like, some people just kind of stick in a lane. And even to tell you Batman Forever, The Lost Boys, maybe there's some similarities there. But I forget what else. I was looking at the thing and we were talking about it.
Oh, okay. The Phantom of the Opera. 2004 is The Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
Which may have been one of the first movies to instill my extreme distaste for period pieces with petticoats.
Period pieces with petticoats. I warm up before we record the podcast.
I just know that if Keira Knightley would be cast in it, I'm probably going to find it incredibly boring.
Yeah, that's fair. I think I'm with you on that. I wish it wasn't true sometimes, you know, but I am what I am.
I know, same. I'm sorry.
Listen, I'll look at it if I hear enough things, you know, but...
Now let me tell you what I loved about Batman for...
yeah. So much. This is a 4-part episode.
Phone Booth.
I think we talked about Phone Booth before. I remember not liking Phone Booth, and I'll tell you why. To me, Phone Booth is like Die Hard 3, but the stuff in between the phone booth scenes isn't there. Because Die Hard 3 is all about them on the phone, and then they're like, you have to go do something, and then they go do it. Phone Booth is great title. All Phone Booth.
I probably would have been 11 when I saw it mm-hmm. around there, mm-hmm. so I found it incredibly stressful. But I had never really... It's a pretty basic thriller.
I like those like clever setup movies where someone's in a coffin or a car the whole time.
It's a gimmick
love those.
Match.
I like those movies.
It's a gimmick match of movies.
I like those movies. You can make it with your phone.
So The Client, which I guess is appropriate because it comes up.
That John Grisham stuff from the 90s.
The Lost Boys, as you mentioned. St. Elmo's Fire, the most boring of the Brat Pack
movies. Yeah, never saw it. Flatliners. Shot by Jan de Bont.
Some kind of a Lenny Kravitz music video.
All these guys, they did 50 music videos before they ever made a movie. The worst movie you've ever seen, the guy directed 40 music videos for, like, fucking Madonna and Michael Jackson and Pearl Jam before that. Those exact bands. It's just contract. A hell of a thing. Joel Schumacher, I never saw. I don't think the number 23, the Michael Jordan documentary, sorry, the Jim Carrey movie. But Joel Schumacher would work with Jim Carrey again.
Yeah.
Years later.
He doesn't, as we'll get into, he does not have the kindest things to say about some of his principal cast from Batman Forever, but he does have nice things to say about Jim Carrey.
Yeah, you'll notice, unsurprisingly, that some of the other people he didn't seem to work with. So yeah, you know, it's funny because also I think Batman Forever, it's certainly not forgotten. Everyone knows the Two-Face, the Jim Carrey one, you know, with all these things, but it's a little bit maybe the least remarkable Batman movie from the 90s in the sense of Tim Burton's stuff is really beloved. Batman and Robin has this like cult status. You have to see how bad this movie is sort of thing. But I think Batman Forever is getting there or something. But like I think when Batman and Robin came out, I remember very clearly like that was the world going, what is this piece? And that's why they didn't make any more for so long.
Yeah.
Batman Forever was able to coast a little bit. They didn't quite destroy it the way Batman and Robin did. I think it's a little much, but.
This might be a good time to mention that Chris O'Donnell, who plays Dick Grayson and Robin in this movie and the other one, he was supposed to have his own Nightwing spinoff. Did you know that?
I never knew that until I saw your notes for the show.
Yeah, and so the reviews to Batman and Robin were so instantly awful that it had a butterfly effect. Immediately, like a big ripple of it changed like the course of cinematic history for a bunch of people. He said in an interview, he said that he expressed like, I'm not gonna look a gift horse in the mouth, and he seemed to have a good attitude about the opportunity and that, and I'm sure that that's not an easy thing to cope with. But he did say that some people became very reclusive and were freaked out by how much people hated the movie.
It was a real, again, because in hindsight, it's maybe a little bit more excessively campy, weird, silly something than Batman Forever, but they're not. This was the big jump, the Tim Burton to Joel Schumacher, and suddenly it's colorful and we'll talk about the nipples on the bat suit and it's a different vibe. And then Batman and Robin just like feels like it explored that. There's more to talk about if we were to do it, but yeah, it's weird that it was a pretty different reception to what feel like kind of similar movies.
So as you mentioned, as we might have covered partially, this one stars Val Kilmer as Batman, Tommy Lee Jones as Two-Face, Jim Carrey as Mysterio. I'm just kidding.
the Puzzler.
The Puzzler. Nicole Kidman as... Dr. Chase Meridian. Oh, I liked how Roger Ebert put it. What?
I was going to say that's why I remember it.
Oh.
Because of this. So, otherwise I wouldn't have known. That's very funny. He's very right.
He says, Nicole Kidman plays Dr. Chase Meridian, who sounds like a bank, but is in fact a student of abnormal psychology.
A whole woman.
She's like a hot, horny Clarice from Clarice Starling.
Yeah. She's a little bit like Clarice Starling mixed up with all those girls Batman always meets that are like, there's something about you, isn't there, Batman? And he's like, he just threw a guy off a roof. Quit flirting with him.
Put your tits away. Ma'am.
This is a troubled man.
There's Chris O'Donnell as Robin, which we mentioned. Michael Guh.
It looks like cough with a G.
And Pat Hingle, who sounds like either an old comedian or an old baseball player.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if those last two, I think, are those the holdovers.
Yes, they
Some
are.
Some of the only holdovers are Alfred and Commissioner Gordon, which are like, you know, utility players. So there's a familiarity there. But everything else about this movie is different. Batman and, you know, just director, everything. Yeah.
You see both Alfred and Commissioner Gordon like very almost immediately
it's
in the
wise.
Movie.
Yeah.
And it seems like they're putting them there front and center to sort of bridge the gap.
Yeah.
I don't think you really see Commissioner Gordon much at all.
After that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's not exactly Gary Oldman levels of involvement in the plot.
also some notable people that you'll see in there, Drew Barrymore, Debbie Mazar, there's a George Wallace, then there's an Ed Begley Jr. So what more could you want, really?
We have a few more for later up our sleeve, too. Little cameos. Some you'd notice, some you might not. That was my experience with it. But yeah, these are all ones that I was able to go, is that George Wallace? Is that Ed Begley? These are like lines. These are people with lines and parts. A lot of fun.
So it got a 39, it currently sits at a 39% on Rotten Tomatoes. The critics' consensus is loud, excessively busy, and often boring. Batman Forever, nonetheless, has the charisma of Jim Carrey and Tommy Lee Jones to offer mild relief. Womp, womp.
So that's the thing of it. People that don't like it even have to go, yeah, but you know, those villains are pretty fun. Right?
Yeah. Because, I guess we'll get into this more, but it does very much have the campy, quippy vibe of the Adam West Batman series.
Yeah, and I think that you could say that it's more, it definitely has a neon colorful palette, and that almost harkens back not only to Adam West, but just comic books in general, kind of, I think might have been the attempt. You have very well sourced research, and I might have just read this anecdotally, but I believe that Tim Burton was not a huge Batman fan, and you know, so he has his vision. It feels like a fucking Tim Burton movie when he does it. And Joel Schumacher's like, oh, the comics. Let's do the comic books and the old stuff a little bit. I don't know if that's...
Well...
Is that you looking at me like it's dubious a little bit?
I don't know about that second part because he didn't understand why... why it had to be so dark.
Yeah, okay.
It's like, well, the Batman's whole fucking origin is...
Yeah, right.
I get what he means, I guess, but...
hey, lighten up, that, lighten up, why don't you?
With that, I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. But you're right, where it is spiritually, like, my first exposure to Batman was watching reruns of that Adam West show. Mm-hmm. Loving it. It was probably the first favorite TV show I had. And so watching this, you go, oh, and even as a kid, I was closer to having watched those reruns, but it was a little lost on me how... The similarities, it doesn't beat you over the head. You wouldn't confuse it for Adam West, but there's a lot of, you know...
Overt references.
Overt references, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's great.
They could have done with an Eartha Kitt, though.
Yeah, they could have rolled some of the people in there into parts. That could have been fun if on our notable appearances we also got to mention Frank Gorshin and, you know, everyone.
Cesar
Romero.
That
would have been incredible.
Have you heard this one? It'll kill you, Batman!
As we've mentioned, Joel Schumacher... took over the Batman franchise, and part of the reason for that was because the studio executives wanted to make a more marketable, more palatable movie. They were bummed out by how Batman Returns performed financially, even though it still made money. It wasn't a smash hit that they wanted.
It's like Batman, regular plain Batman was like mega huge, and Batman Returns was merely huge.
And then... Batman Forever made a shitload of money. It was 1995's top earner.
Number one of the year. That's cute, because you always go, oh, Batman's going to do well, whatever. Any movie that does number one for the year, that's huge.
Yeah, and it also, at the time, set a record-breaking opening weekend gross of $53 million.
Incredible.
It earned $184 million domestic that year, and $336.5 million worldwide.
So much for a movie in 1995. I mean, a lot now, but also it's almost like what a Marvel movie routinely makes now, or a Batman movie or something, at least that. But back then, it was just...
On a budget of $100 million.
Yeah.
So it made so much fucking
money. And it's a thing that had a lot of, you know, potential dings going in. Like, hey, we got a new Batman. We got a new vibe. It's all kind of like, you know, yeah.
So it was also, surprisingly, it might be the first Oscar-nominated movie... We are discussing.
That's so cool. Thrice. Nominated thrice.
It was nominated for 3 Academy Awards.
And I'll say this. One might really surprise you. You know? Like, I feel like movies like this to get...
I know which one you mean, and I'll close with that one.
Yeah. Okay, here we go.
Rule of Threes.
Here we go.
Probably not surprising. It was nominated for Best Sound and Best Sound Effects Editing. It lost to Apollo 13 and Braveheart, respectively. But the one that I was surprised by was that it was up for Best Cinematography.
I love that. You know, it's not crazy at all to see, you know, movies like Transformers that or whatever. These movies that take beatings sometimes, you have to go, oh, yeah, well, I had the best special effects. I had the best sound. I had the best sound mixing, all these things. See a Batman movie like this, not even like a Christopher Nolan Batman, but a Batman movie with 39% on Rotten Tomatoes that they had to begrudgingly go, you know what? It's one of the best photographed films of the year. Put it up there with Braveheart and Apollo 13, goddammit. I love it. I love it.
It did lose to Braveheart.
It did lose to Braveheart. It couldn't compete. Gotham City couldn't compete with the rolling hills of Scotland, I think?
I think so.
Yeah.
Blue-faced Mel Gibson.
Too bad, yeah.
Yeah, so critics hated this movie. And they did my favorite thing, where they try to be really funny.
Oh, yeah.
In their reviews for how bad the movie is.
Yeah. You got some for us?
I got one. Yeah. This one was my favorite just because of its concision. Brevity is the soul of wit, of
course. That's right.
Also known as Batman Whatever, the third installment in what appears to be a never-ending series. That was Sheila Reid from Women in the Life.
What is Women in the Life? Hey, okay, question. Would it be weird if Women in the Life fucking loved Batman? I mean, why not?
Not the Michelle Pfeiffer one. Roger Ebert gave it 2.5 stars. I thought
technically a recommendation, right?
Yeah. He says, in his review, he said, there is no rhythm to the movie, no ebb and flow. It's all flat-out spectacle. Is the movie better entertainment, meaning than Batman Returns?
Mm.
He said, well, it's great bubblegum for the eyes. Younger children will be able to process it more easily. Some kids were led bawling from Batman Returns, where the PG-13 rating was a joke.
Yeah. It's a twisted movie, yeah. Batman Returns.
I was so afraid of the Penguin, but I still liked the movie.
And I could see why parents wouldn't be thrilled, because the Penguin is disturbing and violent and aggressive and abusive, and he leaks black goo out of his mouth. And then the Catwoman is like an S&M sex lady.
Absolutely.
Fully seducing and wearing leather. It's just, it really covers a lot of bases if you're a parent that's
wearing latex.
That's right. So it is just, you know, if you're a touchy parent, I don't know.
Yeah. Parents groups very much hated the movie. They freaked about Batman Returns, that is. They kind of threw a shit fit. You know, at one point during the movie, maybe like halfway through or somewhere on there, I told you, I think it won me over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And its biggest flaw, I think, is like a lot of movies like this, just too long. There's just way too much stuff in it.
Yeah.
2 hours and 1 minute, the runtime, I think.
Yeah.
But I have to say, yeah. Once I sort of realized, I mean, the movie tells you what it is almost immediately.
Let's talk about the very beginning. We mentioned it. You see, well, I think just some shots of the Batmobile. For people, you see Alfred, returning Alfred, so it makes sense. Hey, familiar face.
Mm-hmm.
And then Val Kilmer as Batman, so new, like probably smart to see him. You know Batman. Val Kilmer as Bruce Wayne would have been, whoa. But so it's this familiarity. And then
Alfred asks him,
can I persuade you to take a sandwich with you, sir?
And Batman, who's got a really throaty Christian Bale-esque growl, says,
I'll get drive-through.
And it peels off in the Batmobile.
And I think we might have looked at each other then. It's like, that's just not what I was expecting.
Yeah.
So they were telling you right off the bat, though, huh?
We're having some fun with this thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I appreciate? I appreciate the whole thing. I really appreciate it because it's such a marketed movie. I appreciate that he wasn't like, no thanks, I'll get delicious Burger King. And then that was the first thing that happened.
They tried
to win
McDonald's back.
Yeah, right. Or yeah, McDonald's.
I did want to ask you, though, because I did wonder. I didn't want to sidetrack our viewing, but it did occur to me at that point, like, where would he go, you think?
Yeah, it was 95, so there were less players in the game, but certainly still a lot of the ones we know. It was Mickey D's, Burger King, Taco Bell, Wendy's. Gotham might have its own regional shit that we don't know about. Do they have Carl's Jr. in Gotham City? Do they have Whataburger? Do they have In-N-Out?
Somebody that's kept up more with the comic books over the years, will you please let us know if there is some sort of a canon fast food joint in Gotham?
It's funny just to think about seeing a drive that you drive by you drive by a KFC one day and there's a drive through. It's a KFC with a drive through. I think most of them have that, right? And you see four cars and like the third one's the Batmobile, you know?
And the drive-through people have gotten out of the window and they're like, what are you doing, man? You hit the clearance thing.
Hey, is that Batman behind me? I'd like to pay for his chicken.
Yeah. Nice. I said light ice.
That's right.
I can't do a Batman
voice. You know, you were saying, though, how it's like Christian Bale, like gravel, but it's like, that's also just Batman. People like Christian Bale, and he did it pretty hardcore, to be fair, but also like, people are like, oh, Christian Bale voice. Like, isn't that just the Batman voice? Like, it's not like Michael Keaton was like, hey, I'm Batman.
He was like, I'm Batman. Quite as, you're right. It wasn't quite as gravelly as we
not quite, yeah.
would come to know. Yeah. But it was definitely deeper.
Part of it, though, I think maybe was that Christopher Nolan had, he would have Batman say all these things. Whereas, like, that Michael Keaton only really, I'm Batman. Like, yeah, no, maybe next time, whatever. But, like, Christopher, like, the people of this city just showed you that there's a lot they could just still do about good. And another thing that happened, like, he just goes on and on. I feel for the guy, you know, I'm all fucked up because I just did that for a minute.
Yeah. Wearing that heavy-ass bat suit, probably, mm-hmm. too. But, you know, I'm happy to see generally that there does seem to be an uptick. I don't know if it's positivity in general towards movies or if it's just certain ones. Yeah. But in 2020, after Joel Schumacher died in 2020, and I found a few articles, kind of like positive retrospectives. There's one from Discussing Film called Batman Forever is Cinema, published in September of 2020. They said, Batman Forever is very self-aware. It knows that it's a Batman movie, and it doesn't shy away from that precious fact at all. Instead, it embraces the nature of Tim Burton's preceding, edgier, larger-than-life superhero story while adding the fun, showy elements of the 60s Batman series.
There it is?
Yeah. So, because I felt like a lunatic at first, reading all these negative reviews and not seeing any mention of the obvious reference points.
Yeah, yeah, it's jarring. And I would say with what they got at, too, is, like, you know, adding the fun, showy elements of the 60s Batman. You were saying, like, if the movie had a flaw, it was the length, and I think you're right. I think part of it, too, might be, if it's not, I like it, but if it's imperfect, it's because these two, it's like this, like, these two things collide a little bit. The scene, there's a really funny scene where, like, he kicks down Chase Meridian's big door, mm-hmm. and it feels a little bit like they're doing goofy Batman Forever, but they're still on the Batman Returns set or yeah. something. You know, that's kind of the vibe of the movie a little bit.
Well, they were for part of it. Like, so it's funny you say that.
Oh, wow. Oh, shit, yeah. That's awesome.
I think you pick up on that it feels like two movies mushed together. Too many cooks in the kitchen. It was like a Spider-Man 3 type thing where it just felt like they tried to shoehorn in so many things, and it's because they had this script. They started the script. Here's Tim Burton Batman script, and then when Joel Schumacher took over, he had the screenwriter of The Client do a pass, and that guy added in a bunch of Batman pathos stuff.
Akiva Goldsmith, right?
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It probably should be
Akiva Goldsman.
I took all these notes. I don't know why I'm just not referring to them.
Well, you're fine.
But yeah, so that's definitely why when I read that, it was. That somebody came through and took her big red pen and added in, like, yeah. Batman feels guilty about parents' death. It's why it's such a... It kind of... I did enjoy it, I think, definitely more than I expected. But it doesn't really work all the way because of the mush pile of tones.
There could have been one less thing. And even... Yeah. It occurs to me, too, it's like, I think it just... Like, did you need to have a whole thing with the girl in there? I feel like they feel like that's, like... Maybe that's just like, oh, demographics. There's always a Bond girl, or there's all. Maybe that's not a demographic thing, but just meaning like maybe with Batman or something, they just think there should be
a lady, a
love story. So everyone likes there's something stupid, but it's like okay, in Batman, Tim Burton's first one, you know, you have Kim Basinger, and she gets into the whole duality. Bruce Wayne, Batman, this guy's fucked up. Batman Returns, you have Catwoman, so that makes all the sense in the world that there's some stuff there. So almost if it was just like, yeah, then the girl this time, it's going to be a doctor, and it's played by Nicole Kidman. It's like, we just don't need this shit. There's a lot going on. We got two villains. We're meeting Robin. You know, like, it's all fuck. Yeah, it's overstuffed a little bit, because then that subplot has that tone to it. And then you cut to Two-Face and Jim Carrey bouncing off the fucking scenery like a pinball, and it's great, and it feels like the villains from the 60s show a little bit, but then we're back into the dark brooding... My parents. You know, and it makes sense. Of course, that's part of Batman. But, like, I don't think Adam West once was like, you know, Robin, I miss my parents today. It wouldn't have been right. It wouldn't have fit the show at all. This reminds me of my father, Robin. Did I tell you he was murdered in an alley in front of me when I was just a boy?
If only I had memory repellent.
You're going to have to stop me because I'll do this bit for an hour of... Holy repressed memories, Batman! Okay.
Okay. All right. Well.
We have fun.
I think that's it.
We have fun.
Oh. And I do have one more positive review here. From.
Of a recent kind of perspective.
Yeah. The Observer published something called The Observer. I don't know what it is, but they published something called Batman Forever Dared to Make the Dark Knight Campy Again in June of 2020. She says, in the end, the reason Batman is such an influential character is precisely his malleability and the ease in which so many different creators have been able to transform him in ways both big and small to accommodate their respective visions. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of cool because Batman at this point has been, he's like James Bond. Who's your Batman?
Yeah.
What? And I would have to presume that they're just going to keep doing this.
Yeah. Right? And I'll just say real quickly, too, speaking of that, another reason I think in 1995 it wasn't that jarring to me, I didn't really give a shit that there was, like, so much is made of the different Batman. I didn't really give a shit. And I cared about movies and stuff. I just didn't really care. But also, I think the Batman animated show was running at that time, too, and I loved it. And they both did the Robin story. That's, like, my favorite Batman animated stuff. The Robin stuff is just so good. Robin's Reckoning, it's called. And so it's not weird. There was like all these Batman in the air, but like it's a good point what they made in the Observer there about like that animated show had its right tone of like this is dark, but like a kid could watch it on TV and it's not too dark, but a little dark. Yeah, yeah, interesting.
Totally. So speaking of too dark, Tim Burton did not direct Batman Forever because he was asked to please step down.
He was asked if he wouldn't please direct it. One major obstacle. It's like a VH1 thing. There was one major obstacle between him and the film. They didn't want him to direct it.
They locked the door and held it shut. So Batman Returns made $266.9 million worldwide, which is a shitload. But mm-hmm. it's still, it fell way short of their financial expectations. Warner Brothers had expected them to make a lot more. It fell $145 million short of the first Batman's $411 million worldwide gross.
So $411, suddenly you're like, so just the $266 million, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, but these numbers are so stupid.
And made up and
just
ridiculous.
What does it mean?
Monopoly money. So they tied Warner Brothers, they arrived at the conclusion that Tim Burton's fucking dark gothic Batman ran off McDonald's, and that's what cost him all their money.
Ran off McDonald's.
It was just, it pissed off parent groups. It was deemed too dark and inappropriate for children. McDonald's recalled their Happy Meal promotional tie-in.
No, that's pretty funny. I wonder if there's much precedent there for, it came out and it was just too fucked up. Hey, we can't do that. We can't do this Evil Dead promotion. You know, like, when else is that ever going to happen?
Well, I guess doing a bit of research about this, it seems like the parent groups that were complaining, they took issue with the fact that McDonald's is running these commercials and they have these toys, but instead of apologizing or saying, you know, might not be suitable for all little ones or whatever,
yeah.
They said, well, we're not telling you to go see the movie.
No.
We're merely showing clips of it in our ads. And
yeah, it's probably selling little toys.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we did comb through the film and find the most family appropriate toys, and here is the little rubber ducky that Penguin drives in. Please don't go see the movie where he headbutts people in the face.
I do believe they were making merchandise before the movie was done.
Like they maybe, I wonder if they had some productions or, you know, they know what he was going to look like, but then you see the actual movie and again, he's like Danny DeVito as the Penguin. You like see his weird ass in his suit and like his black oil oozing out of his mouth. He's got his awful fin hands used to really creep me out. Is he like, I enjoyed the movie, but that's like unsettling. That was really gross.
That's just, why is he so wet?
And you would just eat fish like it was a stick of beef jerky or something, like a damn cartoon character or something. He is very much alive, like he is such a sick and twisted version of the Penguin. It's not all wah, wah, wah.
So angular and fucking scary. Oh. But Tim Burton spoke to all this during an interview with Yahoo Entertainment in 2014. He said, I think I upset McDonald's. They asked, what's that black stuff coming out of the Penguin's mouth? We can't sell Happy Meals with that. And then they asked him to please not direct anymore.
Could it be a sweet and sour sauce that comes out of his mouth? We can work with that.
Incidentally, Tim Burton is on record of hating the title of this movie. Toxin. I always hated those titles like Batman Forever. That sounds like a tattoo that somebody would get when they're on drugs or something. Or something some kid would write in the yearbook.
Hey, man, it was fun as hell having you in algebra class. Fucking Batman Forever, dude. I love Batman. Don't go changing this summer. I'll still be really into Batman. Batman Forever. Okay.
And I just, it tickles me that there's information as recent as 2022, mm-hmm. for instance. Mm-hmm. In 2022, they commemorated the 30th anniversary of Batman Returns. And in an interview with Empire magazine, he spoke to his unceremonious end as director of the Batman franchise. Mm-hmm. He said, "Back then they went the other way. That's the funny thing about it. But then I was like, wait a minute. Okay, hold on a second there. You complain about me. I'm too weird. I'm too dark. And then you put nipples on the costume. Go fuck yourself."
It's and a fair point.
I don't think we've properly emphasized the nipples on the Batman and Robin suits.
Mm-hmm.
People were so upset.
It was, yeah.
It caused just a kerfuffle. There was a kerfuffle over the nipples.
Not since Janet Jackson's very real nipple on broadcast television, perhaps, has the nation been so captivated. But not even nation. Later, there's someone who says international. Yeah, so they put some nipples on the suit, and
should we go to the? You want to just cover the bat nipples now?
You want to skip to? Let's skip to nipples. Yeah, we got some stuff here.
We have a whole section of bat nipples.
And I'll just say real quick, it is weird, and I think maybe maybe it didn't seem that weird because it is, you know, those suits like you can already see like the abs and the pecs and stuff. So you might argue like, well, let's just make it more anatomically correct and let's.
That's exactly what Joel Schumacher.
It just
said.
Seems like you could make the argument like it's 98% there. It looks like a shirtless man just like spray painted. It's dark like a suit, and they made weird choices. You know what's a really funny thing? Adam West's Batman had little light blue eyebrows drawn on his Batman head that was over his thing, and it's of course the fact that it's nipples adds another dimension of it's a weird part to do, but just there's always been little artistic flourishes on the Batman costumes, and they went nipples.
Not too sidebar too extreme, but I just that just reminded me of the Batman character you would do on stage sometimes.
Oh, like, Dom Batman,
like which was essentially just like an old man Batman.
Yeah.
You wore a gray wig, but the best touch, my favorite touch, was that you had gray like fake eyebrows, adhesive eyebrows. And yeah. You stuck them to the front of a Batman mask.
Yeah, which I don't even know the canon there. If they grew, if Don Batman himself had glued them as well, you know, I don't know. But thanks. I think I ran with it from the Adam West thing that always delighted me so much.
You have a mustache too.
Yeah, mustache. I think, you know, like when I lost the mustache and then that character stopped having a mustache, that kind of, you know, I think that might have happened.
What was the thing? Like, what was your,
It was essentially, I'm not even going to try to do the voice. Maybe I might drop it in here. I'll find the audio and drop it in a bit after I've set it up, which is essentially that, like, I'm the guy they based the comic books on, but it's like exaggerated. I was a weird guy that dressed like a bat and they beat me up a lot. And my friend Bob Kane would draw pictures of it, and he made a stupid comic book out of it.
That was years ago, though. Bobby always was a good kid. He exaggerated the hell out of them books, though. I used to fight crime. Sure, I'd do my part. But it wasn't all crazy like them books. The Joker, come on. There was no Joker. They were all jokers, all them punks. And Catwoman, she was just a woman with cats. That's not a crime.
And then just various from there. Just he's just a rambling old man at this point. And he really just likes to go to Bob Evans. That was it. You know. One of my favorite things I've ever done.
Dom Batman forever.
People are always saying to me, how come we never see you and Bruce Wayne in the same place, Dom? I say it's because we don't have the same urologist, that's all that is. Bruce did have me over to his place before. He said, come on by for dinner, we'll talk about all this nonsense. So I go over there, I can't believe this place, he's got gargoyles in his house. He takes me to this giant banquet hall, I say, what's this, Bruce? Are the Knickerbockers coming to join us? He says, no, it's just us. I said, come on, Bruce, let's go to the Bob Evans, we'll get a smaller table.
Back to the bat nipples.
Yeah, sorry.
To speak to what you said about it being more anatomically correct, that's exactly what the intention was.
It's fucked up. I hate that I sort of like explain the nipples. Like, here's why, you guys. This is why they do the nipples, okay?
Joel Schumacher. And maybe, I don't know, maybe there was like hyper scrutiny on the nipples because it's a gay man directing the Batman movie now. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But mm-hmm. he said, I had no idea that putting nipples on the Bat suit and Robin suit were going to spark international headlines.
Yeah.
The bodies of the suits come from ancient Greek statues, which display perfect bodies. They are anatomically correct.
You should have seen what he wanted. Should have seen the first version. That's how you get the nipples, is you pull the first one has full everything. And you're like, no, okay, well, can I have the nipples? Yeah, take the nipples.
Sure,
that's how you do it. It's the oldest trick. He's an experienced director. It's like that producer's trick to get the casting done. You do the same thing with body parts.
It seemed to plague him for the rest of his time on this earth.
I mean, I remember
in 2014, yeah. when asked if he was surprised that the bat nipples were so controversial.
This is some 20 years later.
He said, I think that will be on my gravestone. It's how I'll be remembered.
Oh my God.
And yeah. I'm sure, like, he was probably asked about it more recently than 2014.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, I made The Lost Boys. People still, no? The nipples? You want to do that? Okay, yeah. No.
But maybe what got people thinking so hard about the nipples was the fact that later, after Batman puts on, like, a prototype of a new bat suit,
mm-hmm.
there's a prominent shot of the Batman buttocks.
Yeah, his ass in the suit. Bunch of quick shots. The wrist, the thing, the belt buckle, the burr, and then the ass. And it, like, lingers for a second. It's hard to miss. It's too much. Way too much.
Let's go back to Mr. Roger Ebert here, mm-hmm. because he puts it pretty well. In his review, he said, throughout the movie, the dominant images are of fetishistic gear. The belt buckles, boots, gloves, capes, masks, and, of course, the cute little dime-sized nipples on Batman and Robin's chests.
Very cute. Very cute.
When Batman tries on his new prototype costume late in the movie, and there's a close-up of its gleaming buttocks, the audience chuckles knowingly. Oh, and that we did. Actually, I think we might have just stared at each other.
Something, but, you know. How truly, if you think of all the different Batmans, from Adam West to fucking Ben Affleck, everything in between, how many have gotten a laugh with his ass? And I don't know the answer.
I didn't see Lego Batman.
You know, yeah.
That's my guess.
Yeah.
But people, like, critics immediately had a problem with the fucking batsuit nipples.
Mm-hmm.
The Brian Lowry from Variety, he raised an interesting point, actually. He said, one does have to question the logic behind adding nipples to the hard rubber batsuit. Whose idea was that supposed to be anyway? Alfred's?
If I may, sir. It occurs to me that maybe it's just like, people saw this movie and they didn't like it, their initial, and that, you know, everyone, it's fine. But they didn't, it becomes this sort of symbol, this rallying cry that all these people could unite behind. The nipples were kind of like the bat signal of a sort.
Do you think Alfred presented different dimensions?
Let me see a butt. That's what you put down there.
Chris O'Donnell. I would surmise that everybody connected to this movie has been asked about the choice, but
we
Chris
could do
O'Donnell,
a podcast on it.
Who again played Robin? He said it wasn't so much the nipples that bothered me; it was the codpiece.
Yeah.
The press obviously played it up and made it a big deal, especially with Joel directing. I didn't think twice about the controversy, but going back and looking and seeing some of the pictures, it was very unusual.
It's just a couple little dime-sized nipples.
Cute little dime-sized.
But it's just distracting because then it, like, you're so aware. And now that such a thing has been made of it, you do notice it or whatever, but you just go, yeah, like, it's not, it takes up a little 1% of your screen or something, but it is just, you're like, but they made that choice. And then you can find yourself being distracted and maybe in that way. While things are happening on the screen, dialogue and good cinematography, Oscar-nominated cinematography, you're going, why are there nipples on the suit? Do they have a function? Am I going to see that by the end? You know, because it's like James Bond or Batman, they're always like, oh, I have this new gadget. It does this. And you're like, oh, I know he's going to need to use that by the end of the thing. Is he going to use the nipples?
Chekhov's nipples. Fun fact. Approximately 75 bat suits were made during production of this movie.
They couldn't get the nipples right?
That's 150 nipples.
Joel Schumacher just looking at nipples with a magnifying glass going, no, no, no! We won't be shooting today. We'll be back next week.
Cinematographer.
I made him a real tyrant.
I'm not going to win the Oscar with this. Look at the shadows.
Yeah.
All right.
So that was nipples.
That was nipples.
Uh-huh.
So, and this is, I feel like every big superhero movie in this time period had like 100 people that were rumored to have almost started the movie.
Oh my god, yeah.
But this movie had so many.
A parade of people.
Not even just rumored, like, oh, they were on a list, they tested, they whatever, but people that were supposed to be in it, that it just fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the most obvious and the most notable is Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton was supposed to reprise his role as Batman. Warner Brothers offered him $15 million to do the movie, but he just didn't want to do it because he didn't like Schumacher's direction. He didn't like the script, succinctly.
Why does it say nipples on the first page of the script? Joel?
By the way, poor fucking Michael Keaton. He's asked about Batman Forever, a movie he was not in.
Yeah.
Every time he does an interview.
Michael Keaton talks about Batman more than Val Kilmer's had to talk about Batman.
And he always seems happy to do it. I'm sure he's just getting a variation of the same question for the last 30 years. But in 2017, on the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter podcast, he just, of the script, he said, it sucked.
There you have it.
He said more, but I think that boils it down.
Yeah. Just didn't like where it was going. I mean, it's just pretty, it's tied, Michael Keaton not being there is tied pretty directly to Tim Burton not being there, ultimately, I think, right? Just like, Michael Keaton was making the Tim Burton Batmans, and the thing started to feel different, and he didn't necessarily like where it was going.
Yeah. He just didn't like the brighter direction. He said, I knew it was in trouble when Joel Schumacher said, why does everything have to be so dark? Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, well, he witnessed the death of his parents. But not only that, it had to be brightened up. It became a thing of, let's do bright colored cameos. So, mm-hmm.
I guess, I guess we all have a Batman, right? Where if you said it like that, I could see, but maybe just like, hey, remember the TV show? What if we did that a little bit more? And you still don't have to like the Vision. I just don't think it's like so crazy.
I know.
You could really, I'm not trying to talk shit about Michael Keaton, but if one were so inclined, you could really be like, oh, that's not Batman, it's a dark thing. And I was like, yeah, but also like Lego Batman's pretty fun. Adam West is pretty fun. That's what's so great about Batman, like you were saying before that quote about it. It can be a lot of things. It could be the center of the universe, I've heard.
I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
But after Michael Keaton passed, Rene Russo, who was supposed to play Dr. Chase Meridian, not a bank, she was deemed too old to be Val Kilmer's love interest at a staggering 5 years older.
5 years older than Val.
5 years his senior.
Wouldn't buy it.
Get that old biddy out of here.
But also,
so she was swiftly replaced with Nicole Kidman, who is 8 years younger than Val Kilmer.
So 5 years older, unbelievable. 8 years younger, that's fine.
Yep.
Question, though, I'm not trying to necessarily defend this. It sucks. Rene Russo's great. She would have been great in that role. I can picture her in it easily. Val Kilmer's a love. Is it just like, we think Batman likes him a little younger? It's not the Val Kilmer love interest. It's the Batman. No, because it shouldn't matter, because Batman's Batman. Yeah, never mind. I talked my way out.
That's good, because my answer would be, oh.
Yeah, fuck it. But no, it's just, I mean, you know, Nicole Kidman's fine in there, but like, I don't think it reads drastically differently than, you know, like, who would honestly look at Rene Russo and go, really, Batman? You're dating Rene Russo? Like, wasn't she like I don't know.
She was the looker in Get Shorty that same year, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, a year later, Tin Cup.
Oh, right, of course. So imagine, if you will, a universe where we got Marlon Wayans as Robin.
Yeah. Picture Michael Keaton in this movie, Rene Russo as Nicole Kidman, and then
Marlon Wayans.
Possibly as, most different than the ultimate result, Marlon Wayans as Chris O'Donnell as Robin.
so he was cast, Marlon Wayans was cast as Robin in Batman Returns, but the character was written out of the movie. In 1998, during an interview with the AV Club, Marlon Wayans said, I got paid for almost being Robin. Actually, I was Robin. They paid me, and then they decided they wanted somebody else. I was like, hey, as long as the check clears, baby.
I like that attitude. I was Robin since I got paid to be Robin. Like, Robin exists. We just didn't happen to see him in that movie. But there is Robin.
He said, I got the role, and I was supposed to do the second one. I got my wardrobe fitted and everything. And what happened was that there were too many characters, and they felt Robin wouldn't be of service. So they put me in the third one, meaning Batman Return, or sorry, Batman Forever. And when the third one came around, they got a new director on, and their vision of the project changed. They decided they wanted somebody white to play Robin.
Oh, boy.
But he did tell in an interview in 2009, he said he still gets residual checks.
I bet that makes it a little sweeter, huh?
I think so.
I mean, to get a check for a movie you're not even in 25 years later? Cheers. Well done, Marlon Wayans. And it sounds to Marlon Wayans, obviously, if you didn't know, Marlon Wayans, one of the many Wayans brothers, Damon Wayans, Keenan Ivory Wayans, many others from In Living Color and stuff. So it sounds a little, whoa, really? Maybe at least. But he would be in things like Requiem for a Dream and do some, he's pretty good in that movie in a serious role. So it's too bad, really, that it just seems like so unlike anything we've really seen him do. It's one of these fun alternate universe things where Marlon Wayans is running around beating up Tommy Lee Jones.
He might have been onto something, though, with his theory about their vision of the project, because one other high-profile person that was in the running for Dick Grayson was Leonardo DiCaprio.
Young Leo. Pre-Titanic Leo.
There's been a long-standing rumor that Leo screen-tested for the role, and in 2015, he said that he never screen-tested, but he did have a meeting with Joel Schumacher. Just one meeting, and he did not end up doing it. When asked if he actually wanted to do the role at the time, he said, I don't think I did, no. As I recall, I took the meeting but didn't want to play the role. Joel Schumacher is a very talented director, but I don't think I was ready for anything like that. And when asked if he felt like he had dodged a bullet, he just laughed.
Well, that's polite.
Yeah, it's polite.
I think the Billy Dee Williams thing is interesting. This movie, Batman Forever, has Harvey Dent, a.k.a. Two-Face, a.k.a. Harvey Two-Face, as they call him at one point. Like someone who couldn't quite remember the character's name.
They keep calling him Harvey Two-Face.
This is what I call him when I can't remember his name. Harvey Two-Face. The Harvey Dent full-faced, no disfiguration, one-face, Harvey One-Face was in Batman, 1989's Batman, played by Billy Dee Williams, a.k.a. Lando Calrissian. And then I think you have it in here. I didn't mean to step on your thing. I'm sorry. Yeah. I just get excited about Billy Dee Williams.
Please.
But the plan was to make him Two-Face at some point.
Yeah.
Until it wasn't.
Yeah. In 2013, at a Comic-Con, he said, I'd hoped that I would have done Two-Face, but it changed hands before then. And I think Schumacher got involved, so they took a different direction with that. He's singing that same song.
Man.
So similarly to the Marlon Wayans thing, I guess it was rumored, people thought that Billy Dee Williams was also getting at least a payday from that. Mm-hmm. But he said that that was not true. He said, you only get paid if you do the movie. I had a 2-picture deal with Star Wars. They paid me for that. But I only had a 1-picture deal for Batman.
Sucks.
Poor Lando.
I know a fun bit of trivia about that, though. Did you come across this? That
the Lego Batman thing?
He would voice the character in the Lego Batman movie years later. So another reason for fun Batman things to exist. They can right the wrongs of history.
That's really fun.
That's really fun. That's a classy move.
There is one contentious casting snafu.
Yeah, these are all pretty amicable, it seems like, in the grand scheme of things.
Maybe just a little like, a little bit. It would have been nice.
Things happen, they're still paying me, didn't work out, but...
However, Robin Williams would later say that he was screwed over twice by Batman.
The production's not... The man.
Not the man, I think. But, so, for 1989's Batman, he was offered the role of the Joker, but it was basically just to get Jack Nicholson to get off the fucking...
Get off the pot. Or shit.
Yeah.
Whichever one.
He believed, according to the 2018 book Robin by David Itzkoff, they made him an offer, but they never had any intention of casting him. They were set on Jack Nicholson, but Nicholson needed a little prodding to sign on, so they pulled an old producer trick by starting negotiations with another star to force a decision from the one they actually wanted. He's quoted as saying, I replied, but they said I was too late. They said they'd gone to Jack over the weekend because I didn't reply soon enough. I said, you gave me till Monday. I replied before the deadline, but it was just to get Jack off the pot.
Mm.
So he was offered, Robin Williams was offered the role of the Riddler in Batman Forever, but there is not a consensus. Some reports say that he turned it down because he was still a little salty about the Jack Nicholson thing. Mm-hmm. Poor guy.
Robin can't catch a break in this episode. That's the theme.
Oh my god. Damn. We haven't even gotten to what I thought was one of the gnarliest details about Robin.
Mm.
The Dick Grayson Robin.
Well then, the theme continues.
Bum bum bum. So, probably the weirdest one.
Of someone who was almost in the movie?
As far as the cast that wasn't. Joel Schumacher had intended for Bono to be in the movie.
U2's very own Bono, who I can't recall ever seeing act in a film.
No. Well, he might literally be in Across the Universe, maybe? But that's not acting.
Even so, he's not, you know, it just that doesn't seem like someone you'd go to.
Well, it was like they were doing cross-promotional stuff, because he was doing some character, Mephisto, they wore like, painted his face and had devil horns.
I read that in your notes. So the band U2, at some point in the 90s, tried, I'm sure you wouldn't confuse him for Kiss, but that's what it sounds like when you say he started painting his face and going by a name and shit like that. Like, they were trying a thing.
He's doing a little thing.
You try a thing.
So, I guess Joel Schumacher wanted him to be in Batman Forever. In 1994, he told the Sun Sentinel he asked to be in the movie, meaning Bono asked to be in Batman Forever. I wanted him in it, Joel Schumacher says, but there wasn't a role for him in the film. But I guess he considered letting him dance around during some party scene.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I could have him standing on a piano in costume as Mephisto. But I wasn't sure it would work out for him to sing an entire song and advised him the idea wasn't a good one for him. And he agreed.
So I pitched him an idea. I also told him it wasn't very good. And he was like, you're right. And I was like, oh, see you later. Maybe Bono was like, can I be in your movie? And he's like, oh, I have to play this just right. I have to come up with an idea that he will say no to. Well, all right.
So
a bunch of people that almost were in Batman Forever.
And as far as people that were actually in the movie,
no one had fun.
Oh my gosh. Would you guess that this movie had like a bunch of rivalries or just contentious relationships?
Not to jump around, but maybe the least surprising thing is that like Tommy Lee Jones didn't love showing up at like 5 a.m. to get a bunch of makeup put on be in the Batman movie all day. That's like, yeah, it's not, you know, it's sad. In a perfect world, everyone gets along all the time. Mm-hmm. But to hear that he might have been a bit cranky,
yeah,
the least shocking part here, I think. Yeah,
definitely.
About other things, though. So, more shocking.
After Michael Keaton passed, Joel Schumacher ended up casting Val Kilmer, obviously. But I guess he had a lengthy list of possible replacements, which included Alec Baldwin, Johnny Depp, and Kurt Russell, who had just starred in Tombstone, which was a big box office hit at the time. But Schumacher was more interested in Kurt Russell's Tombstone co-star, Val Kilmer. He said that in 2015, Joel Schumacher said that Val gave a really scene-stealing performance. And while watching it, he said to one of his friends, God, he'd make a great Batman, wouldn't he?
You know, you talk about, oh, Kurt Russell was on the list, and then Val Kilmer had a scene-stealing role. He had a Batman stealing role.
Whoa.
He was so good. He stole whole movies.
A movie stealing
He didn't
role.
Steal a scene. He stole a movie. A different movie.
He's been described as the dreamiest Batman.
Okay. Some might say Clooney, though. Is Clooney kind of considered dreamy?
When you see Val Kilmer as Bruce Wayne, and he's got like the perfectly coiffed hair and the glasses, and just I think he might be the dreamiest Batman.
Yeah.
But this is a quote that I liked from Steven Goldblatt, the cinematographer. Val Kilmer was the most beautiful Batman. The perfect face for that mask. Those lips.
Yeah, right. The part of his face that sticks out of the mask is pretty good looking, huh?
His memoir, Val Kilmer, I'm Your Huckleberry. God, that's a fucking...
I'm Your Huckleberry.
That's not a fun word for me to say. He claimed that he accepted the part without reading the script, and he said the part is a trap, and the trap was the suit.
Mm.
But it might have been more of a that might not have been a very metaphorical thing, because I guess the suit weighed close to 100 pounds.
Right. So you might think he'd say, "Oh, the trap is you don't want to say no to this lucrative franchise, this opportunity to advance your career." But like, no, the trap is you wear this thing all day, and it traps you from eating or going to the bathroom comfortably.
And once you have the helmet on, I guess. essentially deafens you.
Oh.
Which I'm sure didn't help.
So you're in a little isolation tank.
Yeah.
Sensory deprivation suit. Walking around.
Your director's getting more and more pissed off at you. You're going, what?
I'm sorry. I think I'm in a desert right now.
I did like this this little story that I guess comes from his memoir. He talks about agreeing to show the movie to his kids a few years after it had come out, but he had to drive into town because he didn't own a copy of it on VHS. He said after the film started, his children quietly shuffled out one by one within the first 20 minutes, and he found himself watching it alone, like a chump.
That's awkward. But kids will be kids, man. Kids are brutal.
Yeah.
Kids will leave the room when they're watching their father's Batman movie.
That's harsh.
And this is in the, you know, this is in the 90s, so I would say these days they'd go get on their iPad or something, but they probably went and made some fucking...
Went outside.
Made a fucking phone call on a landline.
I'm going online.
I'm watching Batman Forever. It sucks. My sucky dad's in it. No, I don't know.
I'm in the chat room. Chit-chat rooms.
Hang up the phone. I'm going to get online.
So, there were two high-profile, shall we say, contentious relationships on the set of Batman. Mm-hmm. One of them, Tommy Lee Jones, hated Jim Carrey. And the other was Joel Schumacher hated Val Kilmer.
All these people that should really get along, like... That are going to spend so much time. The director and Batman, Two-Face and Riddler, did not get, like, it's too bad. Now, if Batman didn't get along with Two-Face, you'd think, well, we'll use it.
Sure, yeah.
It's not, it seems like these very much were obstacles they had to overcome.
Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels not getting along.
Right.
Use it, guys.
Use it.
So, in a 1996 interview with Entertainment Weekly, Joel Schumacher just kind of detailed his intense relationship with Val Kilmer on the set. He said, after just a couple weeks of shooting, Kilmer's behavior had eroded to the point where Schumacher says he and Kilmer had a physical pushing match. This is a quote. He was being irrational and ballistic with the first AD, the cameraman, the costume people. He was badly behaved. He was rude and inappropriate. I was forced to tell him that this would not be tolerated for one more second. Then we had 2 weeks where he did not speak to me, but it was bliss.
I'm so sorry, but I just connected two things. Like... What if it was just him desperately trying to communicate to people?
He can't hear you? Yeah.
I was forced to tell him this would not be tolerated for more. He can't hear you. He's just trying to find out where lunch is or something. Will you help me go to the bathroom? He's accosting the first AD, the cameraman, you know. Just two different...
They're on completely different wavelengths. And so that was in 1996, but then in 2019, during an interview with Vulture, Joel Schumacher says, I didn't say Val Kilmer was difficult to work with on Batman Forever. I said he was psychotic.
He wasn't difficult. It was just that he was psychotic.
So it's funny that you say that, you said earlier, that Tommy Lee Jones being grumpy didn't necessarily surprise you.
Tracks, right?
He started grumpy.
Okay, yeah. Day one, grump.
According to producer Peter McGregor Scott, Tommy Lee Jones's initial reaction to the script, I don't get it.
That almost sounds like I just picture him all wistful, like No Country for Old Men. He reads the script and just stares out the window. I just don't get it. These movies they're making anymore.
I don't get it.
It's fucking Batman.
Why'd he do it?
Well, I can take a guess. I could take 5 or 6 million guesses. Whatever. 10, 2, I don't know.
Yeah. And as you referenced earlier, also, Tommy Lee Jones, as Harvey Two-Face, he had a bunch of prosthetics on his face, and that process took hours.
It looks awesome. So... It looks like it takes a long time. You know, you look at it and it's like, geez. The wardrobe's great, of course, but just like then to just sit there and have that perfectly, like half your face is, I don't know.
Burnt?
It's pink. Acid, it's but pink. It made them all purple and pink. But I don't know what acid does. Not in Gotham, especially.
Yeah, this is a quote from Stephen Goldblatt, the cinematographer. He said, Tommy Lee, of course, in his prosthetic makeup, which he had to endure, it didn't put him in the best of tempers at all times, having to be in makeup at 4 or 5 a.m. for 3 hours.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I could imagine that. That making him even grumpier than usual.
Yeah.
And I think the person that bore the brunt of his grumpiness was Jim Carrey.
Poor young Jim Carrey, who's like tearing up the world. He's having... He's younger than Tommy Lee Jones, but he's actually been trying to crack into the business for a little while. And now he's been on In Living Color for a few years. And now he's coming off just a run. He's like the hottest guy right now.
You looked it up earlier. Didn't he? He had a few movies in 95, right?
Yeah. So he 94 was when he came out with Ace Ventura and The Mask were huge. And then in 95, it just full steam ahead. He had three movies in the top 20, which is just wild. And I forget the exact, but this Batman, the number one movie, of course, Batman Forever. And then I forget the exact breakdown, but then also Dumb and Dumber and Ripley wants to answer.
Ace Ventura.
And then Ace Ventura When Nature Calls the following year. Oh, they got that sequel out a year later. So yeah, three movies in the top 20. Jim Carrey is as big as movie stars get almost, I feel like, at this point. Certainly from a comedic place, doing the big high-profile comedies, doing the roles in Blockbuster. Yeah, just maybe Tommy Lee wasn't into his... Well, I don't want to step on the line. Okay.
Yeah, so did you know... Were you aware of their contentious relationship before all of this?
I don't think I was. Before we heard the one anecdote we liked a lot.
Yes.
And then all this more stuff or whatever. No, I don't think I knew that really.
Yeah, so I think Joel Schumacher put it pretty succinctly during that same 96 interview with Entertainment Weekly. Jim Carrey was a gentleman and Tommy Lee was threatened by him. I'm tired of defending overpaid, overprivileged actors. I pray I don't work with them again. He was a little bit more even-keeled about it when it came up again during an interview with Vulture in 2019. Because he had worked with Tommy Lee Jones on The Client.
Just like right before that.
Yeah. So he says he was fabulous on The Client, but he was not kind to Jim Carrey when we were making Batman Forever. Tommy is, and I say this with great respect, a scene stealer. And, well, you can't steal a scene. Whoa. Let me take that again.
I see what happened here. We all see what happened. We all understand.
Tommy is, and I say this with great respect, a scene stealer. Well, you can't steal a...
scene?
From Jim Carrey. It's a fucking tongue twister.
That works. That's why you broadcast with a partner. Exactly for moments like this.
It's impossible, and I think it irked Tommy. By the way, I think it's hilarious that people who know Tommy Lee Jones call him Tommy Lee. Do you just picture Tommy Lee from Motley Crue?
Yeah, I do know.
Yeah.
You know what happened, too? It's really obvious. Well, he was great on The Client, not on Batman. Like, The Client was, as far as if you're an actor, you're like, oh, I'm like pacing around in a courtroom, going, Your Honor, ladies and gentlemen of the courtroom, like doing... You probably just feel like
Atticus Finch.
You're using your fucking acting chops or whatever, yeah. Right? Whereas now you're sitting in the makeup chair. That just probably makes actors like that grumpy, maybe.
And you're
right?
Delivering like jokey lines, and yeah. Like so he's two-faced, and his lair is one side is light and one is dark, and he's got two ladies. The ladies are Drew Barrymore and Debbie Mazar, Sugar and Spice. One is blonde and. You know, Angel, and then yeah. Debbie Mazar's like
twisted, dark
latex Betty Page.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so the two... I could imagine just. That's why I ask, like, why did he do this?
It's a fascinating take on Two-Face, where there's some things that always are there. He's always, you know, split down the middle, disfigured. He's always got a coin, and it uses it to determine things, and it's the duality, the 50-50 of it all. But this is a Two-Face that drinks two sips of drinks at the same time, because two sides of his mouth apparently are thirsty for two different things, is how far the disfigurement goes.
He says us. He refers to himself in plural. Says does us. That happen elsewhere?
He's got custom suits, yeah, I don't know about the us elsewhere. I and he's got the custom suits, and it seems like he's like the ladies are both making him dinner and shit like that, you know? And I it's a real literalness to his duality in this, instead of just this whole like, oh, mirror to Batman, two sides of a thing, whatever you do. It's like, no, I want hot dogs and whatever. I'm not sure if that would be the good or the bad one.
Can I raise a crass question?
Yeah. It's yes.
When you just look at the differences in his two aesthetics, even down to his ladies.
Yeah.
Does that mean either side of his...
Yeah.
Is into a different thing?
Well, not at once. We did it, didn't we?
Oh, boy.
But I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Let's land it in here. That's good. Let's calm down.
So, Joel Schumacher, he conceded that, suffice to say that Tommy Lee Jones did not act towards Jim the way an Oscar winner with a star on Hollywood Boulevard, being the oldest member of the cast and having such a distinguished career and the accolades to go with it, should have acted towards Jim. But what happens on the set stays on the set.
Wow.
Apparently.
Okay. Well, you know, the details, like, I think I get it.
I think I get it.
I think you told me what happened on the set in so many words, but I don't know. Yeah, it sucks. It's not, sounds like it's not cool. Like, he said, oh, Oscar winner, that's right, with a star on the Hollywood Boulevard. Yeah, you know.
And at that point, it probably would have been, like, really cool to have a nice experience with a really storied actor.
Tommy Lee?
Yeah. But, alas, he hated Jim Carrey, and Jim Carrey knows that because Tommy Lee told him that to his face. Jim Carrey has told the story in a couple places, but he recalled bumping into Tommy Lee Jones shortly before they had their biggest scene together in the movie. He just showed up at a restaurant that he happened to be eating dinner at.
And the maitre d' said, "You're working with Tommy Lee Jones, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "He's in the back corner. He's having dinner." I said, "Oh, great. I'll go say hi." And I went up to say hi, and the blood drained from his face in such a way that I realized that I had become the face of his pain, you know, or something. And he got up kind of shaking and hugged me and said, "I hate you. I really don't like you."
Oh my.
Wow.
And I was like, "Wow, okay. Well, what's going on, man?" Like that. And he said, "I cannot sanction your buffoonery."
Wow.
Yeah.
Later in the interview, he guessed that I was the star and that was the problem. But he said, "He's a phenomenal actor, though. I still love him." So that's nice.
What none of this talks about, yeah, and you know, it's nice to see that maturity there. But I wonder, and it's, you know, it's none of my business, and maybe it's crass or something, but like, was there a payday disparity that's like, I have won an Oscar, but maybe Jim Carrey's walking in making a bunch of money because he's like the fresh new kid, and it's like, well, who the fuck's this guy that I didn't hear of before last year? I'm wildly speculating, of course, but...
So we heard the "I cannot sanction your buffoonery" thing. I thought that was so fucking funny that like,
Yeah.
I'm probably going to draw that in some capacity and probably make a sticker just so I can put it on my own shit, because I think it's hilarious.
It's just
such a funny phrasing.
You know, someone like an actor or any kind of like artist or something is just like, when they really eloquently tell you why they don't like you or something, it can be quite a thing.
It's amazing.
Because you're a fucking asshole? No, because I cannot sanction your buffoonery. Oh, would have preferred the first, you know, the former.
So it was already on my brain very much when we were watching it. But then, sitting through it just the other day, the whole fucking movie is buffoonery.
Yeah,
including Tommy Lee Jones's entire contribution.
Yeah, he might have just been taking all of his misery, again, if I may wildly speculate.
Yeah. And
maybe Nicole Kidman comes to that same diner and "I cannot sanction your buffoonery." He would just say it to anyone involved with Batman Forever that came into the diner that night. I assume it's a diner. He's at an all-night diner.
A maitre d', so...
It's 3:30 in the morning. He's got to be to work in a half hour.
The maitre d' at the diner?
Oh, yeah, you're right. That falls apart.
Maybe not.
It's a fancy place.
Why can't all the Batman villains get along? Arkham Asylum inmates?
Speaking of them, too, I think Roger Ebert mentioned it, that both villains do kind of play the same note, I think is what he said. Yeah. There's no real, point counterpoint to it. They're both just kind of hammy and weird.
I don't know why you would have, because it's not Two-Face like you might have in your brain from Aaron Eckhart in Dark Knight.
Right, who's like screaming about who did this to me and
he's tortured.
I'll kill all of you. And
yeah.
Yeah.
It's not that at all. It's very much like, he's basically Joker times two with, or, like, there's two Riddlers in there. I don't understand why they needed both characters.
And also, one thing I like, too, and this harkens back to the 60s style of it, is he's very much 60s style Batman villain in that he's got a half dozen henchmen that have a dress code. They seem to be into his whole shtick. There's an odd submissiveness to it or something. Like, is that what you like?
Yeah, I what I mean is they visually remind you of the Gimp.
The Gimp from Pulp Fiction. There's like a weird, like a quiet obedience to them or something, right? And it's a bit off-putting if you let it be, or at the very best you're like, oh, henchmen, like the old days, you know. And I do another thing. Just speaking of that too, I like how the movie is episodic. It's the third movie. There's no mistaking that there's going to be a fourth movie. Mm-hmm. So there's no, oh, are we, you know, like wrapping up the, and you know, it's fine. Movies wrap things up. I just, for this, it feels like an episode of the old TV show of just like the very beginning. He's already Two-Faced. He's already just doing shit. Mm-hmm. The very end of the movie, Batman and Robin just run at the fucking camera, which, people thought was real in 1995. That's not true. It's just really telling you, like, yeah, there's a bunch more coming too. You know,
Batman will devour us all.
That's right. But yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't set out to like put a bow on anything or finish anything or even reinvent the wheel necessarily. Of just like, it's like, it's an episode of Batman. Two-Face is here. He's got henchmen.
Yeah, I think ironically, if Joel Schumacher would have just been able to make the movie he wanted to make, I think it would have turned out a lot differently if there weren't so. I think the big issue came from the fact that here's a script, it's done, but then Schumacher had the client person rewrite it or do a pass. Mm-hmm. And then so it just became, here's this property that was supposed to be light, we still interjected some of the darker stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, and it was also just a bunch of people picking up a franchise that hadn't done it. Meaning, you know, like, I'm also figuring out how to play Batman and how I want to direct a Batman movie, as opposed to this is my second or third one and we're going to try some things. It was just like everyone was brand new and it was kind of all over the place.
So to move through to the rest of the cast, we wanted to run through a little bit. Just one little tidbit that I learned about Chris O'Donnell. He didn't have to sit through makeup for 3 hours in the early hours of the morning, like Tommy Lee Jones, but that little mask, it was hot glued to his face.
Ugh.
Yeah.
So there was no taking it off.
This is a quote from an interview with ET. Said, first thing in the morning, they painted my eyes black and then would glue the mask on to my face. It was so hot, you would touch the mask and water would just run down your face.
Wow. Like his own sweat is the water?
I guess.
Okay, jeez.
Or like, I don't know.
Glue?
Melty
hot,
glue?
Hot glue would just run down my face. It's the worst. I looked like Two-Face by the end.
Incredibly painful.
Yeah.
And I still am unclear on Drew Barrymore's status in 95, because when I realized that she had such a small part in this movie, I was a little bit like, what the fuck? How did they get her to do this? Turns out Joel Schumacher just asked her to do it. He asked her to play one of Harvey Two-Face's girlfriends. And then Debbie Mazar, he said, whom I knew as Madonna's makeup artist and had been in Goodfellas. I didn't know she could act, and she sent me pictures that had been taken. She sent me pictures that had been taken of her as Betty Page. A little programming note. The original characters were called Leather and Lace. The studio felt that was a little, you know, so they became Sugar and Spice, the PG-13 version.
Which is interesting. Do they say their names in the movie at all? Would you know what they were called? They could be called fucking Jack and Jill and you wouldn't know it.
I don't know if they do.
I'm not sure. He's like, hey, Sugar, hey, Spice. Maybe it's in there.
Sugar, Drew Barrymore, meets Bruce Wayne at a shindig in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he asks her for her name. And she says, you can call me whatever you want.
Yeah.
And just, Mae West's out of the scene.
Yeah.
But she does not say her name.
Doesn't say her name. And I still think, it's a bit of a small part for her to play at this part, because like we were saying, if Scream was like a year or two later, and that was kind of like a Janet Leigh psycho, oh, you didn't think would kill her off, then me and the dog think that it was a bit, but again, like I said too, maybe it's just like, maybe it's fun, maybe it was a good payday, maybe your friend Joel asked you, and you were like, sure, sure. I'll work with Tommy Lee Jones. I hear he's a gentleman.
Just a good time gal.
Yeah.
Some other cameos worth mentioning, I think, is the girl group En Vogue.
Mm-hmm.
And Jon Favreau.
Yeah. Just like, it never stops. Some of these I didn't even notice. En Vogue are in a funny part where Robin is driving the Batmobile through Gotham, and he gets out of the car, and everyone thinks it's going to be Batman, but it's little Robin, and they're like, "Ham?"
No, no, it's Dick Grayson. It's not even Robin.
Right, thank you. Yeah, just like clothes. Street clothes Dick Grayson.
And
oh, fucking 2 days out of the circus ass. And then, yeah, it's just this R&B girl group, of all people. They don't They don't sing a song at him or nothing. They're just like, yeah.
Yeah, they're just disappointed that it's not Batman, yeah. Naturally. Also, this is apropos of nothing, but Chris O'Donnell looks remarkably like Rob Thomas.
Yeah, he really does. He changed his name and started making music in the band Matchbox 20. Because I think Chris O'Donnell wasn't in movies like as much. I take that back. He probably is just on some TV show I didn't watch. I feel like he's one of those guys.
We talked about the bat nipples.
The principals. We got the principal cast up to and including the nipples on the suit. I want to say just one little stray thing I saw in the notes that I thought was really awesome. Will Shorts, the New York Times' crossword puzzle editor, composed the Riddler's riddles, which is pretty cool. They got a good riddle guy. And also, the way that the riddles are like presented is a really cool part of the movie, I think. It goes just to like the art direction and the stuff of it, of like these cool fucked up collages and
pop-up
things, and they're all like, yeah, it's really good.
They are really cool looking.
And that's definitely, you know, of course the riddles is just part of Batman, but there was something about the stupidness of the riddle and the way it connected to a larger, it felt, that really reminded me of the old Batman, where that was always just like the most ludicrous, like, how did you get that from that? Even if, okay, the punchline's banana, why the fuck does that mean they're going here? Is that, you know, like, the conclusion's made from the thing where it's like, oh, all these riddles. Well, forget the riddles. Each number has a, or each question has a number in it. What do those mean? Or, I don't know, you know, just, they do a whole riddle thing.
That's why he's the world's greatest detective, I guess.
That's right. That's right. He does the riddles. He flies through the New York Times. It's like nothing to him. It's like the junior jumble to him.
You'll find us all in a tennis court. In. E-I-O-U. Vowels.
Not entirely unclever, sir, but what do a clock, a match, chess pawns and vowels have in common? What do these riddles mean?
Every riddle has a number in the question, and they arrived in this order. 13, 1, 8, and 5.
13, 1, 8, and 5. What do they mean?
Perhaps letters of the alphabet?
Of course, 13 is M.
1 would be A, 8 would be H, and 5 would be E.
M. A-H-E.
Perhaps 1 and 8 are 18.
18 is R. M-R-E.
How about Mr. E?
Mystery.
And another name for mystery?
Enigma.
Mr. E-nigma. Edward Nigma.
So, given that Batman Forever made crazy money, its sequel was greenlighted almost immediately.
Because you said at the time it was a record-breaking weekend.
Yeah.
So an opening weekend, I'm sure they're like, you know, this has never happened. Like, no one's ever made this much money in one weekend. So,
It's interesting. Like, they asked Tim Burton, please do not make another Batman movie, please. Because we want to sell toys and merchandise.
I know.
And then here comes this movie that makes a shitload of money. I'm sure they're pumped.
Right.
But,
And then like, great, we'll keep it going. Nothing can go wrong.
Yeah, and Joel Schumacher spoke to what he had wanted to do with the sequel. He said, after Forever's success, I wanted to do The Dark Knight. It was going to be very dark. I remember going to the set of Face Off and asking Nick Cage to play the Scarecrow.
Oh.
The studio, and I'm not sure the audience, was in a frame of mind to go too dark with that man at the time. It's interesting how our culture has changed, how the socioeconomic, political culture makes it absolutely palatable to see Chris Nolan's Batman. For instance, The Dark Knight Rises, which is a comment on exactly what's happening. You might be able to track that on all the movies. Maybe Batman is one of those things like pie. It's the center of the universe. And I just loved that. Just like the Batman movies specifically are a barometer for society.
Yeah. You could argue that, and then again, I don't know what the Lego Batman movie does to all of that,
mm-hmm.
but maybe.
I think it still works. Lego Batman, that speaks to where we're at, I think.
When that happened, was the whole world just ready for some levity or something? Or were we all starting to put some shit together, man? Like, oh, Legos. Gosh. Like Legos, man.
Here we go. You said right historical wrongs with Billy Dee Williams' casting.
Yeah.
So
I remember thinking, like, okay, I don't know if I care about this. Like, so this exists. Who cares? Lego Batman. But then it was just like, oh, Batman hasn't been funny in so long. You almost forget he can be funny. Especially because it was like after all that Christopher Nolan stuff and everything else. And yeah, and he got to write the wrong of Billy Dee Williams. And I think there's even a clip of Adam West dancing as Batman in there. So,
What more could you want?
What more could you want from a Lego Batman movie?
So, amazingly, was this a mid-90s thing? The soundtrack that doesn't necessarily have fuck all to do with the movie?
I think so. I remember the phrase, it's not on this one, but you'd see music from and inspired by the motion picture. Like, yeah, okay, the fucking Offspring saw Twister and were so motivated and inspired they just had to write a song. But also it was a rough cut of the movie because it's also included in the soundtrack of the movie inspired by. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. But it was like record company promotional tool.
That might explain what's going on here.
I think
so. But some other interesting tidbits. The RZA produced the Batman Forever soundtrack.
Wu-Tang Clan's own RZA.
Bobby Digital. Yeah. RZA curated a pretty eclectic mix of musicians for the soundtrack, which includes Brandy, The Offspring, PJ Harvey, Mazzy Star, Sunny Day Real Estate, The Flaming Lips, and Nick Cave.
Mm-hmm.
And a pretty dope Method Man track called The Riddler.
Yeah, produced by the RZA. It sounds just like a classic Wu-Tang song, and it's tucked away on the Batman Forever soundtrack. So even though it was a single and it was a video at the time and it like did like okay, if you're just like, you know, if you weren't into the shit back then or didn't know or whatever, it could almost be like a lost hidden gem track, which is it very much is, I think. The Riddler by Method Man. Yeah.
Super cool. Definitely recommend pulling that up on the old YouTube machine.
And when I say it was maybe a modest hit in the sense of it was a single and it was out there, but there was a smash hit on the soundtrack.
Oh yeah. And you might be surprised to learn that this movie, or that this song was on this movie's soundtrack.
Ba 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 ba.
Really good demonetized.
That wasn't Seal. That was me. Oh, yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
No.
Yeah, so Kiss from a Rose by Seal was originally written in 1987, and it might have faded away into obscurity if not for Batman Forever. Upon its initial release in July 1994, nearly a year before the movie, it dropped out of the charts quietly. It went into the charts at number 60 and dropped to number 80-something the next week, and that was the end of it. It was over, that Seal said in a June 2020 Instagram video. So then, while Seal was working on his next album, he got a call from Joel Schumacher asking if he could use one of his songs for a love scene in Batman Forever. So he ultimately chose Kiss from a Rose, although there isn't a love scene in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The track ended up over the end credits.
Yeah. Second song.
Not
even like, because the first song, even if you leave the movie right away, you hear that first song because that's the end of the movie. It hits and the credits roll even for a second. You hear it. But so it's tucked away after the U2 song. And Kiss from Roses, it's like one. Maybe this is, there's a lot of different ways you can measure this. To my brain, a kid that grew up in the 90s, it was one of the biggest songs of the 90s, right?
It was the album's biggest hit and helped Seal top the US Billboard Hot 100.
I mean, there you go.
And interestingly, I did not know this, it wasn't the first time the song had been included on a movie soundtrack. It had also just featured on 1994's The NeverEnding Story 3. What the fuck?
That's hilarious. You can go back and watch The NeverEnding Story 3, and that if you didn't know this, if you didn't listen to our podcast, which thank you, you would go, they can't do that. Why did they have to go, why they got the Batman Forever song in there? What bootleg copy is this?
And it's really weird that it got tucked away as the second end credits song, because Seal said Schumacher loved the song. Joel Schumacher shot a new music video with Seal performing in front of the Bat Signal, which was a huge video, because again, this 95.
I remember the video.
So,
Seal
said he didn't even charge me. He said he loved the song so much. Subsequently, kids thought I was Batman because the song was so big.
Yeah, and he is like, the video's like, you just use the props you can, or who knows if it means much or anything, but it's just like he's standing in front of the bat signal, but you might infer that he's answering the bat signal because he's Batman.
Sure.
You know, like if you take it that one step further.
The fuck else would he be doing up there?
You know, shouldn't be up there. Unless you're operating or answering the bat signal, you shouldn't be up there.
It's irresponsible.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
So, oddly enough, as recently as 2020, there was a new development in the Joel Schumacher Batman universe. A fabled Schumacher cut.
Ooh.
Of Batman Forever. It started from a tweet from writer Mark Bernardin. He said that he heard from very good authority that a 170-minute cut of Batman Forever exists, but Warner Brothers was unsure if there's any hunger for what was described to me as a much darker, more serious version of the film. Not long after, Variety confirmed with a source close to the movie, I don't even know what that means, close to,
mm-hmm.
That Schumacher did assemble a longer cut of Batman Forever that was indeed much darker in nature. They reported the longer cut opens with a sequence involving the villain Two-Face escaping from Arkham Asylum and features extended scenes with the Riddler where he invades the Batcave and uses his signature cane as a weapon.
Oh.
The bulk of this version's runtime focuses on the emotional and psychological issues that led Bruce Wayne to decide to become Batman, including a sequence of Wayne facing down a giant human-sized bat, which I think we see trickles of that with that
dream stuff. Or
yeah,
the
weird...
It's all that, like, virtual reality TV stuff. We didn't even talk about the fact that this movie is largely about the Riddler coming up with 3D television. But it's also to get into your brain.
It already did, man.
That's right.
Saying something here, man.
Now you can be part of the action. Nygmatech brings the joy of 3D entertainment into your living room. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you... My vision, the box in every home in America, and one day the world.
In local news, Edward Nygma's 3D box has become the rage of Gotham. Rioting occurred last night at electronic stores which were sold out. There's hardly a home without the Nygmatech box. Critics have claimed the box turns Gothamites into zombies, but Edward Nygma just shrugs. That's what they said when TV was invented.
Oh, and I just liked that they had a nice note, too. The Variety noted that after Schumacher's passing, it sparked a renewed appreciation for his unabashed embrace of theatrical extravagance in his Batman movies. Even Batman and Robin has developed a cult following for its high camp excesses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's nice.
It's fun. It's a big, ridiculous kind of Batman thing. The parts I don't like are these, like, subdued parts where he's talking to the girl about his fucking dead parents, and it's not even in any kind of interesting or, you know, like, I don't dislike the neon Gotham City stuff or the crazy parts where, like, there's a lot of stuff we were talking about that it's like the old show. There's a part, but it's, like, with a twist. There's a part they shoot a grappling hook up. And the Batmobile drives up the side of the building. There's even a prominent shot where people look out the window and go, oh, I'll be goddamn, that's Batman. They did that every single week on the Batman show. A lot of times they were just walking up the thing and some guy would open the window and it would be a celebrity. It'd be Sammy Davis Jr. going, what's going on out here or something. But like it was there. Oh, this is the 90s blockbuster version of it. So the fucking Batmobile drives up the fucking thing. Somewhere I saw there was a note where one of the screenwriters were talking about like, well, when we write a movie, we say, well, how's the car going to get down from there? It's like, yeah, okay, I get it. You like are a writer, so you think about this stuff. But to paraphrase another story we like a lot that we'll cover sometime, it ain't that kind of movie, kid, right? But that's what I like about it. So just to say that, like, well, they say even Batman and Robin has developed a cult following for its high camp excesses. It's like the excesses are the best shit of these movies.
Completely.
The stuff I don't like, I know I just said this, but yeah, it's like where it's sort of, it's like it feels, a lot of movies have this, movies that have one too many subplots or one too many characters or pacing issues. It's just like, I'm sorry, did the movie I enjoy just call Time Out? Because it seems like, you know, we're at like a pseudo sort of break in the action or something. And that's the worst part about these movies. So that said, I'm skeptical with a 170-minute cut. It's like, well, is there more like Nicole Kidman stuff? Because no thanks. You
well,
know?
It sounds but it's just a bunch of the darker shit that was not the most fun part of the movie, but I don't think we talked about this specifically, by the way, but speaking of an overt reference to the Adam West Batman, when Bruce Wayne takes a date to the circus and they watch Dick Grayson's little band of identical Robin circus family perform, and it's like Two-Face shows up and there's a giant bomb. There's a big giant bomb.
You know how Batman villains will show up and just take an entire place hostage? Football stadium, circus. It's really quite a thing. Hospitals. They do that thing. Yeah, hospitals, yeah. They do that thing.
Yep. So he does that. He brings a big giant, big ol' bomb.
Big classic bomb.
And a boy that we, or oh, man, we don't know how old he is.
Mr. Robin?
Rob Thomas.
Robin Thomas.
Oh my God. Robin Thomas grabs the bomb. And it really just reminds me of, like, some days you can't get rid of a bomb.
Yeah, it's very much like kind of the gag from the 1966 Batman or the movie where, yeah, he's got the big bomb. He's trying to get rid of it. But again, in this movie, it does have to go off because we're doing a bit more serious thing. We are trying to kill off the parents. So, but although the bomb doesn't do it. So he actually does dispose of the water. He does dispose of the bomb through the roof, through the water, which I think might even be what Batman ends up doing with that bomb in that sequence.
Rolls it down the building and then it goes into the
So there's a number of like, quite literal, it seems like, overt connections there.
Yeah.
It's a hoot.
I cannot.
He's the boy wonder. I do wonder, like you said, the age thing, where it's like, he's just a kid. It's like, he's got fucking sideburns. He looks like he's 24 or something.
He knows how to fix up motorbikes.
Yeah, the movie treats him like he's 15 or something, and he just like, but.
He looks like a grown man.
And then he's dating Rene Russo? What was that about? I'm kidding.
Maybe Batman is like Pi.
Yeah.
Maybe it is the center of the universe.
The center of the universe. The only logical takeaway. So is that kind of it?
That's kind of it, I think. I know that you had a couple things that you had wanted to... that you had thought about bringing up there.
Over here, meaning? Or
I just stuff that we talked about.
I have a few stray thoughts. One thing I like a lot... the beginning, Tommy Lee Jones, the Two-Face, Harvey Two-Face, is in a helicopter... and at the end of it, he just jumps out. He puts the club on the helicopter, on the steering wheel. I don't know if anyone knows the club, but that was like a big 90s thing. It was this apparatus you put on your steering wheel so no one could steal your car. And as a kid, I used to think it was really high tech. Oh, that's not... but oh, it's only because it's so big and awkward and clunky, it would make you bonk into everything. So I like that this really elaborate plan with he's hanging a bank vault off a helicopter with a hostage in it that slowly starts to fill with acid. He's like, also, at some point, I'm going to use the club that I got off TV. I called a phone number and got it off the infomercial, and I'm just going to jump out of the helicopter. So
it's like Acme-esque.
Yeah, it's a very Acme thing. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I said about the episodic nature. I talked about the big door. I thought, as someone that grew up watching Jim Carrey stuff a lot, his performance is really interesting. Like, of course, it's like unsurprising. Here's Jim Carrey. He's being big. He's being loud. He's kicking. He's yelling. But... as someone who, like, he does portray a lot of, you know, as the man, Edward Nygma, which I want to talk about that in a second, too.
Oh,
but
boy.
Less the Riddler, more the man that's, like, slipping. It's like, there's some pretty interesting stuff he does. It's all maybe a little hammy. He's still coming off again. He's kind of doing it in his big way. But I almost thought this is, like, his Riddler is maybe halfway between Ace Ventura and Andy Kaufman, though. Like,
completely.
There is some acting going on there, you know, and I thought that was pretty fun.
Plus the mask.
Yeah.
Like all of just his running around.
And... just right, yeah. But and also just like guys that are really straddling something, some sort of a line between, you know, yeah. So that was interesting. It's not exclusive to this movie, but like this movie really hammers home the Edward Nygma thing, where it's almost like some Batman properties are like, look, he's got the stupid fucking name. The Riddler's name is Edward Nygma. E-Nygma. Yeah, what do you do? It's a comic book. It's fine. I think some things that go for more realism are just sort of like, Edward Nygma, and they move on. But I like in this movie, not only do they do it, but they come up with this extra thing where he goes, oh, Mr. Enigma. It's just like, I think you're reading way too much into it. I don't think Mr. E was ever supposed to be part of it, right? Maybe it is. The riddles are that deep with him.
Well, I guess the puzzler that he uses like a Clueless-esque computer program to help him come up with a name for his... scary alter ego, and at one point it suggests, or he floats the Puzzler, and I guess that's another Superman thing.
That's right, yeah. I like that.
I don't give a fuck about Superman.
My wife doesn't give a fuck about Superman.
I would happily sit through Nick Cage's Superman, though.
Though that's, you know, we talk about, you said how you hear all these things about people that were almost in movies. That's like a famous whole movie that didn't happen, but the Nick Cage Superman.
because of all this, right? It was a Tim Burton thing.
It was a Tim Burton thing, and I think Batman soured him on the whole thing. He's mm-hmm. like, I don't want to make any of this shit that's going to be tied to McDonald's. You know?
That's a good rule of thumb, I think.
They didn't do McDonald's with Dark Knight and stuff, did they? Or did they?
I don't think so, because it's like, when you watch Dark Knight, it opens, it kind of reminds me of Point Break. Because it's really just like a stressful, violent bank robbery.
Yeah.
And every time I watch that movie, I'm surprised that it's PG-13.
Yeah. But there's a history of that in Batman. We're all over the place at this point.
Yeah.
I think I'm good.
Me too.
Yeah. Let's call it. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. It was fun talking about Batman Forever. We enjoyed it more than the critics of their time.
Batman Forever? We hope so.
I know it, right? I said that before. This was the fourth, really. If you're counting 1960s, you got the fourth Batman movie. It goes Batman, and then Batman, and then Batman Returns. And then at some point, like, Batman Forever. We're doing this forever. And then there's been a dozen
it's like
more since then, if not more.
You know that joke in Spaceballs where it's...
Coming up, Pongo's review of Rocky V. 1,000. Pongo?
But that's it.
5,000.
I do like Batman Forever, though. People knock it. The critics didn't love it. One of the 8 or 9 best Batman movies.
It's really not as bad as you might expect.
But I do think that should do it for this episode, right?
Yeah.
Anything
sure
else?
I hope so.
Let's do it. Ripley, you good? She's good.
We'll catch you guys later.
Bye.
Movies, get out of here. Ridiculous. Batman Forever, oh, I hope not. Not with these hips.